Welcome to the DSAIA podcast, where we interview experts and leaders in the Down syndrome community about the topics that are on our minds and affect how we deliver programs and resources to our families and other constituents. Hi, my name is Dina Tharp. I'm the Executive Director of Down Syndrome Affiliates in Action, and I have an exciting interview I know you're going to love. It was recorded during our Facebook Happy Hour broadcast, and we are talking about building a better cookie jar. Let's get to it. And this time we are talking about something that, you know, nobody really wants to talk about in a nonprofit. And that's fraud, embezzlement, you know, that stealing from your organization. In the past month, there has been a story coming out of Tulsa that the former president, board president of that organization has been indicted, has been charged with stealing from that organization. What they found out, and I will kind of cut to the chase here, it was a small amount, but during interviews with investigators, former board members revealed that the person that was charged was the only person with sole control of the organization's finances. And then let's scroll back to a few years, back to 2017. It probably started in 2014, back in Tampa, when the Tampa Down Syndrome Network, actually, the organization's founder was actually indicted and convicted. And that, and I'm looking at that story right now, she's paying restitution with threat of jail time. But I think that was around $87,000. Funds were going to pay mortgage, groceries, things like that. Someone mentioned, I think on one of our Facebook posts the other day, that this happens every few years. Every 10 years or so. I think it happens a lot more than that. And a lot of groups don't report it or cover it up because, let's be honest, this is not good for any nonprofit. And it's especially not good for Down Syndrome Associations. And oh my gosh, for your organization. So that's our topic tonight. And our guests who I brought in to talk about this are Jane Page Steiner. And Jane is a consultant, nonprofit consultant. She is also a Board Source certified trainer. But once upon a time, she was the executive director of Down Syndrome Association of Greater Cincinnati. And she's been a huge friend and help for DSAIA. In fact, if you are on a leader circle, you can thank Jane for that. So, and then our other guest is, did I miss anything, Jane? Would you like to add anything?
That's a nice little wire.
Okay. And then we have Amy Van Bergen, who is a founding board member of Down Syndrome. Oh, does she switch drinks? Down Syndrome Affiliates in Action. She is also the former and retired executive director of Down Syndrome Association of Central Florida. And she does consulting now. Anything else you would like to add?
Even though I am from Florida, I had nothing to do with the group with the woman who was convicted.
And she is also the son of a young man with Down syndrome, as am I, but her son is Wills. And will you please tell Wills that I am sorry and I appreciated texts and messages inviting me to go see The Nun with him, and I wish I could come.
Sorry you missed it.
I am too. I really would have gone. That's kind of my thing. I really But, you know, anyway, let's get talking about this. Jane, I'm kind of going to start with you. You know, let's talk board's role, because in the end, they are responsible for the organization. And what is their responsibility in this area? You know, I mean, you're not just warming that seat. You're accountable for the actions of your organization. So get us in that direction. What should the board member?
You make an important point, Dina. I think at the end of the day, the board holds the ultimate responsibility in this arena, because one of the primary responsibilities of all nonprofit boards is to protect assets. And that's a very broad term, but it's very inclusive. And so in that is for small and large organization. That's a primary function of the board, is protecting assets and ultimately protecting the reputation of the organization. Because as you alluded to, if something like this happens within your organization, it can quickly spiral into disaster, even if it's not a large amount of money, because it will hurt the reputation of the organization to the point that donors may pull away, and sponsorships and other things you do that are the lifeblood of your organization. So ultimately, the board has the responsibility to protect those assets by setting up procedures and controls that will protect the organization's assets. So I didn't know, Amy, if you want to talk more specifically about some of that, or how you want to kind of jump to the next thing.
I would agree with what you said, Jane, wholeheartedly, that it really is in the hands of the board, whether you have an organization that has no staff whatsoever, or if you have a ton of staff. And I would say the two, if you bring away nothing else from this conversation tonight, there are really two practical steps that you can take as a board member or as a staff person bringing this back to your organization that can help reduce fraud. And that would be the transparency around bank accounts. So if you only have one person currently receiving copies of those statements, either hard copy or electronically, designate, volunteer somebody else to also be receiving that, because even the appearance of transparency to the person who may be considering it will be enough of something to discourage them from moving forward. And the second thing I would suggest as a board member would be, and again, you can designate yourself. You do not have to be a bookkeeper. You do not have to be a CPA to conduct some kind of surprise audit, not the kind that you do by accounting firms that we all do at year end to, you know, help with keeping our house in order, but just as board members to say, hey, I've got some questions. I want to go over the bank statements from last May. Can you explain this check and this one and this vendor? I don't remember that name. If that's a surprise, if that's coming, and to your point, Jane, if you can put language and procedures around those so that everybody understands that, no matter who they are in the organization, that will go a long way.
And I think this can be a very, in particular for DSAs, a challenge, because oftentimes DSAs are smaller. Some don't have any paid staff, or if they have paid staff, it might be one or two people. So they're dealing with less people. So the inclination is, well, you know, this person's going to do, you know, maybe everything related to the finance. And that goes against all the best practices of segregation of duty, where you have, you know, two people signing checks over certain amounts to, as Amy sort of talked about, that you make sure the person that's opening checks is not also depositing checks. I mean, simple things that you can do to put in place to make sure that, you know, one person sort of isn't in charge. What, you know, from my experience and from, you know, going to a lot of, you know, having a lot of discussions around this issue, you know, fraud is often about opportunity. And prevention a lot of times is just by limiting that opportunity and that temptation, hey, I can do this and nobody's going to ever know. And so the protections are put into place for the protections of the individuals. So that is Amy and Dina have sort of said that it's always about, you don't even want the suspicion of any wrongdoing. And sometimes donors will even ask about, you know, what are your policies and procedures around this? And I'll talk to people about the idea that, you know, it's never about people, it's about the process. So if you have somebody that says, well, wait a minute, you know, I've always done it and I have, then, you know, this is to protect them. And you can say that to them. This is about not only protecting the organization, but protecting the individuals that are involved so that no one's ever pointing a finger or, you know, misunderstanding anything that's happening within the organization. And this can be challenging, again, for DSA boards that maybe have board members that don't have a lot of experience in the financial world. And you don't have to be an expert at this, but again, it's sort of what Amy said, it's about asking questions and being willing to take the time to really understand the financials and, you know, what's coming and going.
Oh, you said something earlier, is that, you know, it's almost a crime of it's opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that, and I know I want to say this, I'm not letting anybody off the hook, but when it's easy to do, it's easy to do. And the way that boards and organizations as a whole can make it so that it doesn't happen is make it hard.
Yes.
Make it difficult. I know that people are like, there's so many, you know, hoops you have to jump through and so many regulations and so many policies and procedures. They are there for a reason, and they're really there just to protect the person that's really not there to steal from the organization, but it can be done.
Well, and I think it is something that, you don't have to do everything at once. I mean, this is a culture shift. It's making this a priority within the organization. And those of you that are board presidents and are on a board, or maybe your staff members, can talk to the board about making this a priority. And then in the coming year, just sort of look at, okay, what changes do we want to make? And it doesn't necessarily have to be very real complex, but even making some small changes like two signatures of checks, looking at how you handle cash. I mean, there's hardly a organization, DSA, that doesn't do some sort of walk or buddy walk now. And oftentimes that means a large amount of cash that may be in one day, right? And so even looking at things like that on how you handle cash and make sure that it's deposited in a certain way, and, you know, there's a double check, so not one person again is doing all that.
So, but before we get into the nitty gritty of, you know, like that kind of stuff, because I think that's important. Jane, as a board member, are there things that if I'm sitting at the board table and I am not involved, I'm not on the executive committee, I'm not a treasurer, what are the things that I'm supposed to be looking for? What are the policies and procedures that I think I need, you know, I mean, because those kind of things are very detailed as we get into,
yeah, sort of getting
how we handle cash at the walk. But what are the things, just if I'm coming into a board, I'm just a new board member, what am I looking for?
Well, one of the most basic things, and I actually have seen this in some DSAs, is have a budget. I mean, and look at that budget. I mean, some I've seen occasionally organizations, they have sort of a budget, but not really. But really that they're doing that projection of what's the anticipated revenue and what's the anticipated expenses, because that's literally how approval of expenses, that beginning of that process is put into place. We've got this amount of money for printing, right? Like, let's say $500. So first of all, just having some of those basic type of documents in place, asking about that and looking at it, and does it make sense? As you look at it, do I understand it? Do I get what this is? If not, let's ask questions about why it is like this and maybe better understand it. I think the other thing is, do they have a finance committee? Because oftentimes the finance committee will be charged, finance and or audit committee will be charged with looking at these kind of details. And usually they're the ones that will help the staff and or the volunteers come up with policies and procedures around that. And so those are sort of some of the beginning things that I think I would recommend people would begin to ask questions, especially as a new board member. And then, you know, asking about how are the financials given? You know, usually financials are given at every board meeting, but that doesn't necessarily mean that kind of information is, you know, discussed. Usually you're just discussing, you know, what the current assets are or what the expenditures was. But I think it's during those discussions, you can bring up some of these issues around checks and balances also.
Right. And Joe kind of mentioned that, kind of reiterated what I was saying, is no one joins a board with the intent to embezzle. It happens through apathy of the organization, and it happens.
An opportunity.
When it becomes too easy and the opportunity is too great with no oversight, the temptation becomes too great. Not saying anyone with temptation might take the advantage. Most will not. But when it's made so easy for people to show their root colors, they really will.
Yeah, so, I think that's an important point. And what the boards need to remember, it is ultimately their responsibilities to it's their responsibilities to make sure that those safeguards are put into place. That is not, now oftentimes they'll delegate it to an executive director, but ultimately the board is responsible for that.
Right. So I'm showing his comment now. Okay. And then the next one where Shannon, I'm going to post hers. Jane mentioned best practices and gave an example of not having the person open the check, not the same person makes the deposits. Is there a list of best practices somewhere that addresses procedures on that level? We do have, always recommend that people who are members of DSAIA go through the accreditation process, because that gives you a lot of policies and procedures and checks and balances. And, but when it gets down to the nitty gritty level, we do probably have some resources for you, but,
National Council on Nonprofits has some great ones. Do you have some board source Look materials there?
Well, this Jane. Is it upside down?
Can you see it?
So this is actually from Ohio, though. This is from the Ohio Attorney General, and it outlines some of the things that Shannon was asking about. I'm not sure every state attorney does this, but I mean, it covers exactly what you're talking about. It gives a checklist of things to keep in mind, particularly for nonprofits. And there might be something at Board Source too, that, Dean and I could maybe look into and see if it's available.
Yeah.
But the other thing is Kathleen, yes, very much. Accountants and CPAs know this stuff backwards and forwards. And so if you have anybody on your board or someone on your finance committee that's in that profession, they absolutely could help you with this, and or your auditor.
And the term that you'd be looking for to ask them would be for samples around internal control procedures.
Yeah.
That's the key words there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is internal controls. And we do have a webinar in our archive for those who are members on internal controls that kind of go through some of the things. But, every organization is different. You kind of have to take the thought, the concept of it and implement it in how it works in your organization, because some of you have staff, some of you do not. Even with DSAIA, we're in a totally different position where we're not all in the same building ever. And so it's a totally different thing that we have to worry about. So we've had to come up with some totally different type of controls. And
I was just talking to a group a couple weeks ago, and they have a PO box where all of their mail is collected. They're all volunteer. And it's one person who goes to pick up those. And not only are those bills, but obviously checks and donations being sent in. So I talked to them about, you should regularly set up, I don't care who the other person is, but create a procedure around, you will meet another volunteer. I don't care if it's at your house or Starbucks or Panera or someplace near the post office, where you will open those together. So just like when you count cash, you should always have two people. When you open those checks, you should always have two people.
Well, and the other thing related to the board, that this is, and it's much more common now. You didn't see it years ago, but you see it much more now, is for boards to develop a whistleblower policy. And this allows staff and or other volunteers or board members to report without any repercussions. And the thing that I like about it is, because it sort of seems self-evident, oh, yeah, of course people report it? Not really. I mean, because people are concerned about what's going to happen. And I think just setting that policy is saying to the community, this is our culture. This is something we believe in. It's so important that we will protect people if they come forward and investigate if it's inaccurate, is it an accurate perception of what's going on or not, but that you will pursue those type of input or accusations that come up. And that can be related to a lot of things, not just financials. It can be related to sexual harassment and other things. But particularly around this, I think it can be particularly helpful. I think one of the challenges I see within the nonprofit community, particularly for the smaller ones and the DSA world, is the fact that so many times they're like family members and friends, and family members and friends don't report on each other. They just don't. And so one of the things that I discourage at the board level, having same family members on the board. It doesn't mean that spouses can't share, be on committees or do other things. But I think one of the other ways, and it can happen, is that you have a couple people within, friends or family that are actually colluding and making things happen.
And when board members don't have training to read a balance sheet or budget, trouble is coming.
I wouldn't concur with
all
that.
True.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is a piece of that too, because I think that's part of the board situation where a board member, like I said, doesn't know the right questions to ask. I feel like that a lot of times in these organizations, the board members they get on the board really with mission in mind, and maybe as a parent or as a community, maybe as a community member, they're really focused on maybe a program, or some type of service, and not really considering the bigger 50,000 foot view of being a board member, which is making sure that the organization runs productively, efficiently, and, legally. So,
well, yeah. Think about, all of us started out, even Dina and Jane, I know once upon a time you were involved in much smaller organizations, as I was before it grew, and we all were serving as volunteers, and we were all spending our own money and our own time, a lot of time. And with that comes a sense of, I'm doing all of this stuff, I've spent hundreds or thousands of my own dollars doing this. And if you don't have those transparent procedures in place, it is so easy for that person, that key volunteer, to go down that slippery slope of, I bought all the supplies for that event last month. And okay, I'm running a little short on my grocery money. We happen to receive the cash, I'm just going to take 25, 30 bucks, I'll pay it back. Mm-hmm. But nobody else notices. Mm-hmm. And that sticks. Or you're buying something online and golly gee whiz, you have a credit card or a debit card, and it can happen innocently enough, not through intentional fraud. I've done it, I will confess, I've done it myself, where I purchased something on Amazon online on a credit card that was not mine. And after the fact went, oh no.
That has actually happened to both me and Joe Mears, because Joe Mears has contacted me and said, I used the wrong card, and I laughed at him. And then here I was in McDonald's and they hand me back the card. And I'm like, that's not the right blue card.
It happens.
It happens. And then I immediately said, I used the wrong card at McDonald's. There's like a $3.23 charge, and I'm going to pay the organization back. But that was not an organization expense, right? And I felt bad. I immediately went and had my card changed to a different color, by the way.
But your lesson there, Dina, is you immediately saw it and created a paper trail for your accounting procedures around it. Yeah. Emailing your board or your executive committee saying, here's what I did today. It was for this amount. Here's the attached receipt. And here's the corresponding donation that I'm doing to reimburse the organization today or as soon as it's caught. Now you've created a paper trail around that error. But again, think of all of us have volunteers in these groups where stuff like that happens and it's not caught. And we need to think about how are those things going to be picked up and all of our key folks and volunteers knowing that they will be picked up at some point.
So
my perception is that it would be very difficult at the boardroom table to discover fraud because the way that board meetings are set up, you're not going into the nitty gritty.
Right.
But some of the warning signs, if for whatever reason, you know, information isn't coming to the board, the information is convoluted or it's not completed, and there's sort of signs that why aren't we, you know, we haven't seen financials in 3 months or this
What happened with both Tampa and Tulsa. They were getting the things didn't match or they weren't getting any reports.
Yeah. And so that can be one of the early warning signs. And that's why I think having particularly a finance committee that is looking at all your processes and putting that in place and having somebody that's reconciling the checkbook to the point that they are looking at that detail and going, okay, here's the receipt, you know, here's the expense, or wait a minute, I've got an expense, but I have no receipt or I can't track it back to, you know, this something doesn't match, right? And so that kind of detailed work is really what is a way to prevent and or discover if something is, you know, and again, sometimes it can be accidental and or it can be intentional. And then obviously you've got a bigger problem. And I think the other thing that I think you need to be really clear with board members and specifically as we talk about the board is around things like how are you going to do reimbursement? Because that's another area that I see sometimes DSAs get a little loosey-goosey about and not really being clear about, hey, you have to get approval for expenses and or, you know, to get you have to hand in a receipt and then you'll be reimbursed based on the receipt, that kind of a thing. Right. So approval of the initial expense, because again, in that moment, they're not acting as a board member, they're acting as a staff member if they're making expenditures.
And a time period.
And a time period.
Like you can't give me an expense report 6 months down the road.
Right. Usually there's a window. Right.
One thing I wanted to add much earlier, Jane, you mentioned the idea of having two signers on a check. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's practically part of a good overall policy to have when you have amounts over a certain amount. Most banks will tell you they don't look at that. So that alone, I don't think would protect an organization. So I would encourage you, if that's all you've got going on at your organization, you need to look further.
I would agree. And I've heard that too, Amy, that I think it's more of an internal thing. It's way that a second pair of eyes are seeing, oh, this check is for the it should be blah, 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 blah. But I've also heard that, Amy, that banks, you know, one signature, it's done. You know, they're not worried about that kind of checks and balances. But again, I think that's why you need a couple different levels as much as possible so that at various points within the check being received and with the deposit, with it entered into the system, with, you know, whatever it might be that some there's a number of eyes on it. Yeah.
Right. So as we're getting into walk season, we have a whole other area that we have to deal with because there's a lot of cash. Oh my gosh. You know, we're talking about checks and signers and going to the post office and, you know, there's a lot of cash. We have talked and I know if you remember DSAIA, you've been on any type of topical call where we talked about this, you've been on all these webinars. We've talked this to death. But this is a big deal and groups still do it wrong. And it's not that hard to put some procedures in place. And it is September 12th. I know some people probably have already had their walks, but not that many. It's not too late to put some procedures in place so that at the walk and right after the walk, you are watching your wallet, as Columbus would say, Marge Barnheiser would say. I love her presentation on that. But yeah, so I'm going to, Amy, what are you doing?
I mean, the best things in terms of this over the years that's happened to the WONK community is the online giving. Mm-hmm. Because for most organizations, that's actually limited what they're collecting cash day of the event, and that's a good thing. Many groups have started to limit day of cash as well, is having early check-ins and turn-in dates leading up to the walk, whether it's the week before, and having incentives for their teams to turn in early, so that those can be brought to a central location and multiple people doing the counting. Our biggest thing at our annual walk, of course, was to limit that exposure, was to have one collection point with multiple designated counters. And once it reached a certain level, we had a police officer as well designated with that team that then actually actively went and immediately went and did the deposit that day on a Saturday. But one collection point, as opposed to having your team registration on one side of the venue and your t-shirt sales on another, one collection point, that way you can control that intake much easier.
For those of those groups that don't actually take that money and just go right there and make the deposit and all that stuff, and they have to take, maybe they take it collectively and put it in a safe or something like mm-hmm. that. I mean, at the end of the day, I know everyone's tired and they don't want to sit there and count ones and fives and tens and, but you know, maybe tape, you know, dated tape and signed on a bank bag in a safe where it's locked, or in a locked file cabinet, where you can meet on Monday morning or, you know, or Sunday afternoon, whenever it's good for you, and with a group, and make the, and do the counting. Don't you think something like that? I mean, you have to have a policy and you have to have some kind of procedure where everyone feels comfortable that one person's not counting it. And I think that one person should not put it in the safe.
Agreed. And you should, for those of us that have safes, you should have policies around access to that as well. For instance, even though when I had, and this would be true of walk season or non-walk event, the safe was located in my office. We had multiple staff members, but the key to the safe, to have a higher level of accountability for me and protection for me as one of the people who had access to the safe, the key was kept out with another person who did not have access to it. So I had to physically walk past all of my staff in order to retrieve the key to open the safe. That's just a simple, silly example of an internal control procedure that helps with that transparency, that it would be another level of, gonna think twice about this.
Which is important. And you know, those things are, I know people are like, oh, I keep all those receipts and I put them in a folder and I have a file, and it's great to have them digital, by the way, it's great. But you know, those things, I know they take up a lot of space, but they're important. They are important.
And you'll forget if you leave them in a folder, you'll forget if you don't deal with them procedurally right away, right, and turn them in or submit them appropriately right away, you will forget. We've got a lot on our plates, so.
I don't know if anyone.
And that, I think, is where that surprise piece, if you have somebody designated on your board, even if they're not an accountant, they're not, and they're absolutely not your treasurer. They're not the person doing any of the bookkeeping, but they've been given the authority to periodically, maybe twice a year, pick an arbitrary time frame, a week, a month, to sit down with the person keeping your books to ask questions. Tell me about this vendor. You know, because vendors are another common thing for people to create vendors that aren't legitimate. That's a way for them to pay themselves.
Now, we said, Amy, we were not going to give people ideas on how.
Oh, sorry. Well, all right. Well, then I'm not going to give specific ideas on what to do. But if you're going to be committing fraud and embezzlement, go big. Don't do it for these small amounts.
So I will share with you guys, because one of the cases that we were looking at was that the person actually deposited checks made out to the organization to their personal bank account. Mm-hmm. That's pretty easy paper trail to follow. So it's not that people are being sneaky about this.
And the other thing that I wanted to mention, that sort of at a systems level, I certainly recommend any of the DSAs that maybe have a budget over $300,000 or they start to get into a little bit more significant money, that they conduct an annual audit. But the annual audits are helpful, but typically they will not necessarily detect fraud.
No.
Because they're not going into that forensic level that they're looking at that real detail. But they can help you, again, identify, do you have best practices in place? Do we need to beef up certain areas? And also, quite frankly, it reassures your funders if you have annual audits. So I think that's a good thing to look into if you're not getting audits, but I would not say that that's a guarantee against embezzlement or anything either. Mm-hmm. But certainly it's a good practice to get into. The justified expense, as one might say.
So Stephanie Parton Glowner says, great to confirm. I'm going to put this. Great to confirm our organization has all the mentioned systems in place.
Yay!
And I should mention that Down Syndrome Indiana is a DSAIA accredited organization. So of course,
kudos to you. That says a lot.
And Janet is, I'm here.
And I know they're accredited too.
They are accredited too. Central Florida is accredited. It's important for us. It's more, accreditation is not about anything more than just making sure that you're a good nonprofit and that you fulfill the basic parts of being a Down Syndrome Association. So our programming piece of that is really small. The majority of it is nonprofit related. And we have someone reviewing that. And the neat thing about going through that process is that we don't say, oh, nope, you didn't pass, and leave you. Like, we will, our reviewer will go through and say, that passes, but I would suggest you beef it up by putting this in. Or that would pass if you would put this in, send it back to me, and we'll go through it. So we're, and for DSAIA members, there's no charge for accreditation, unlike other associations, which it does cost to be accredited. We just really want you to be a good nonprofit. We really do. So,
and you're right that just going through the process helps you think about the pieces you do need to have in place or the gaps, so that you can assign a task force or committee to work on those and think through those for your organization.
Absolutely. And we have one gold accredited association, which is Louisville. So happy that they went, they were like, we're going to do it. We're going to do it all the way. I really appreciate you guys coming on and doing this talk for us.
Special thanks to our guest, Jane Page Steiner of JPS Nonprofit Strategies, and also to Amy Van Bergen. We appreciate their time and their talent and their expertise in today's podcast. And to remind you to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and to make sure that you subscribe to our podcast.